We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace, where changemakers work, create, and lead. Today we are fortunate to have with us Reverend Dr. Aaron Lewis, who is the pastor of Family Church. A gifted man of God with a heart for humanity, he is a best-selling author, spiritual leader, an educational and health advocate. Welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
We are glad that you're here. So for our listeners, what would you like to say about yourself? How would you describe yourself?
Sometimes complicated, but at the same time, easy to understand if you want to understand me.
Okay. And so where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hartford. I was born at Mount Sinai Hospital, right on Blue Hills Avenue, and I grew up on Thomaston Street, which is right off of Blue Hills Avenue, maybe 10 blocks up the street. And I was there for most of all of my childhood, you know, days until around the age of 16, and that's when the family moved out to South Windsor.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. So talk about your childhood development and how that informed your personality today.
Well, my dad was and is a bishop in the Church of God. So it's a very austere Pentecostal denomination, started in 1886 in the Appalachian Mountains and Hills. And they're based out of Cleveland, Tennessee. So it's a very rural type of organization, very, very strict. And so those days were forged in a very, very strict by the book, you know, to the letter of the law type of religion. So that was my early days.
So your father was a pastor when
he was a pastor, and then he became a bishop in the organization when I was growing up, and they're still even a part of that organization. It was a interesting foundation. I guess I could say it was a good foundation, because you have to have something to stand on. You know, even if it's a piece of concrete, or even if it's a piece of wood that's rotting, as long as you're standing, it means that you haven't fallen. But as I've evolved over the years and learned more, I've come to challenge a lot of my foundation, which a lot of people don't do. Most people celebrate their foundation beyond imagination. It's my foundation. It's my start. But even having left the organization when I was in my early 20s, I realized that a lot of its foundation was built on steeped racism in the South, some of which that perpetuates until this very day. And many of the adherents of color from the West Indies, from the South, from the continent of Africa, Latino people, are not really aware, because it's almost like the frog in the kettle syndrome. You know, if you're in that kettle and it's cold, put it on the stove and incrementally heat it up, that frog is going to die. And so I just sometimes am saddened when I see people that are a part of organization that really doesn't benefit them with regards to helping them to become upwardly mobile. I mean, everybody's getting something out of it, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But to be a part of an organization that's inherently against you, it's kind of weird. And so that was my foundation. I mean, and it's not to say that there was nothing good in my foundation. because they gave me an appreciation and a love for God, an introduction to the idea of the Christ figure. It's just as I grew and as I became exposed and as I read more, I began to establish more of a liberation theology, which was diametrically opposed to everything that they taught. And so they taught us how to be good slaves. And so liberation theology was diametrically, it was like, you know, Kryptonite and Superman, you know. So I became a little bit unpopular after becoming very popular in the organization, and they weren't really sad to see me go once I started to claim my ground of where I stood theologically.
And talk about how you started to come to a different awareness, but still were able to stay in love with God.
You know, that's a very interesting question. And it's interesting in that there's so many people that had my experience and they don't go to church no more.
Right.
A lot of people.
Right.
They just pretty much divorced the church and they fell out with the church. I don't know. I guess because I've always been a reader. And so when I was a little boy, I was 6 years old. And back in those days, obviously there was no cell phone. There were no beepers. And, you know, you basically had to be in by a certain time. Mama said, be in by 8. Mama said, be in by 9. You be in by 8 or 9. You're playing outside. My mother allowed me to go to the library. It was on Blue Hills Avenue, also where the old Model Market is. It's where Oxford Department Store is across the street. And so that library is where I spent literally all my waking moments from the ages of 6 to 13. At 13, I got a little cool. So you start playing basketball outside and going to Keeney Park and, you know, chilling with the cats. But for 7 years of my life, I literally spent every day of my life outside of Sundays at the library for a greater portion of the day. After school, in the summers, I was there all day. So I got really, really good friends with librarians. All the librarians back then were very involved. Both the white ones and the black ones were very involved with little kids that had an interest in reading. And so this is no exaggeration. I may have read at least 25% of the books in the entire library.
And what were you reading?
Well, I was reading things. I didn't even know what the word diaspora meant when I was 6, but that's when I was introduced to the word. But I loved all the pictures in the book that showed people that looked like me.
Wow.
Coming through the middle of Atlantic slave trade and the fact that we made it. So my consciousness was always heightened as a little boy. And so I guess I was a little bit precocious as a child. And so it fascinated me that we made it. Like, I thought we were the baddest people on earth. Could nobody be as cool and significant and strong and smart and attractive as black folks, because we made it. You see what I'm saying? And we made it with the least of resources. We made it with the least education. We made it being beat, being tattered, being torn, being derided, everything. We still made it. And even to this very day, I've always thought to myself that for people to have been as attacked, as persecuted, as people of color all over the globe. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about what's happened here in the United States and some of the perpetuations of racism that still continue, as well as South Africa. But a lot of times you don't even think about Brazil. Brazil goes through some crazy stuff with regards to racism. So everywhere people look like us, we're persecuted. So at 6 years old, I made the deductive reasoning that we are persecuted for a reason, because there's something in us that's so great that the oppressor, whoever that may be, because that oppressor and the oppression takes on different forms, does not want us to know. So that led me to read like crazy. So I was reading everything that had to do with Black history. Now, mind you, I was going to Rawson School at the time, and Rawson School in the early 70s is the coolest thing in the world. All of my teachers, I would say maybe 70, 80% of my teachers were Black at Rawson School in Hartford, Connecticut. And they all came from the South, because they all went to HBCs, and they
really conscious.
They were extraordinarily
Name
conscious.
Name some of the teachers that were there at the time.
Oh man, I had Mrs. Gallagher. I had Mr. Williams. He ended up dying of asthma. I had Miss Clater. She still lives out in Bloomfield. She was the strictest teacher in the entire school. She was so strict. Her son has a photography business now, and that's really, really big.
Keith.
Yep. That's powerful. Mm-hmm. And she was one of my teachers. Miss Ford, Doc Hurley's daughter, Mrs. Costley, was one of my teachers. And so these teachers taught us the value of the strength of being Black. They were introducing us to James Baldwin. They were introducing us to Langston Hughes. We had a tremendous exposure. So I didn't grow up in an environment that was devoid of Black significance. It didn't come until the 80s when they started to take Black out of the schools. But for those 10 years, like somewhere, you know, around 74, 75, all the way up until around 81, it was a strong emphasis on how beautiful we were, you know, the big fist, big old afros on the velvet, you know, paintings. I grew up in that era where it was cool to be Black. We didn't know it wasn't cool until around, you know, the mid to late 80s and the 90s. And it was cool to be Black, but you had to be a rapper at that time. So if you couldn't rap, then you wasn't really all that cool. But,
so where did you go to college?
I went to a lot of colleges. And so I went to Central Connecticut State University. I went to Pace University. I went to Life Christian University in Florida. I went to Stanford University. And I also did certificate studies at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And I put, even though I didn't finish here, I always just like to throw it out there. I did a year at University of Hartford because I studied music there, but I didn't finish there because it was just too doggone expensive. I just had to put that out there, mm-hmm. just to, you know, to let them know, you know, bring the prices down.
That's wonderful to know. We're talking to Reverend Aaron Lewis, and we will be back after the break.
We'll be right back. days have passed, and all the queen bee's drones are dying. But we're gonna make it, baby, 'cause we live in Brooklyn, baby.
Tax money?
Are you tired of not having a voice in your country?
Are you tired of big companies getting all the money?
Are you tired of thinking we don't have a voice?
It's untrue. You have a voice.
We would like to take you back to the 1920s. Warren Harding was running for president and everyone thought it was a joke because he was unqualified. Less than 40% of registered voters voted in this election. As a result, Harding became the 29th president of the United States.
Sounds familiar?
Is history repeating itself?
2016, no one went off to vote because they believed Donald Trump could never become president because he was also unqualified. The lack of voter turnout allowed Donald Trump to become the 45th president of the United States.
Neither president has accomplished anything that was promised.
So next time you think you can't make a difference,
remember this situation
and go out and vote.
Welcome back. We're talking with Reverend Dr. Aaron Lewis. So talk to us about that call to ministry and how it showed up in your life.
So I received a call to ministry at 19 years old. So I'm coming out of high school and I am going into college. My first year, I actually have a degree from Manchester Community College. I'm proud of that too, because I believe in the community college system, especially for those that are undecided or for those that don't want to spend $40,000 a year for the first 2 years. And so I went there and that's when I really began to believe that I needed to say something to the masses. And I really felt this this tug on my spirit to go into ministry, use it as a platform to say what needed to be said. And so, of course, then being raised in a very, like I said again, strong Pentecostal evangelical faith, the idea when you were called to ministry is to get everybody saved, you know, because everybody was going to hell, of course, so you got to get everybody saved. And so that was the idea. Then I went to Lee University, and I have a certificate in biblical studies from there as well. And they're out of Cleveland, Tennessee. They had a satellite office in Auburn, and that's where I took my classes with my professors. And so they were indoctrinating us like they do to this day, all of the evangelical schools, and basically in how to recruit the masses to Jesus. At 19, my calling was a little bit interesting insofar as I felt that people, that Jesus could make your life better, that he would, that he, you know, to the utmost, Jesus saves. I believed it. But I felt like there was something more, particularly for people of color, because I felt like we were really in a very dark space and that we were ignorant of what Christ could really bring into the life of a black believer. I'll put it that way, that we were infiltrated, you know, and we were like, you know, cattle going to the slaughter, taught to support a system that supported oppression. And so I saw,
and that was interwoven with the religion.
Yeah, but it was so eerily akin to how the United States was, like, and how corporate America was. It was so weird to me, and we just used God to soften the blow. We used, you know, Jesus to so that when you did get whooped, you felt that it was right to be whooped. We used all of the religious phraseologies to make it better. But I saw the church being and mimicking everything that I saw in corporate America, the dog eat dog, the oppression, you know, the idea that you weren't going to go so far, the law of the lid, you know, the glass ceiling. And when I saw that, I felt that there was a bigger purpose in ministry. And I began to believe that ministry was about not only recruiting people, because that's easy to do. I thought it was about enlightening people and giving people truth that otherwise they would not be exposed to. And so with that, it became a very lonely place for me. At that time, I was 19. I started to evangelize. What you do when you grow up in organized religion and you black, you just find somebody to invite you to their church, you go and preach, and you feel validated. So that's what I did. I would go from church to church and do what I saw other people doing, but it wasn't fulfilling my call, because I would leave the people theoretically in the same position that they were in when I got there. I mean, there was a healing dynamic to the ministry at that time, and I would pray for people that were ill, and when God would heal them, there was a greater sense of satisfaction. But overall, you know, knowing that I left the people as ignorant as I did when I came, it bothered me, and that caused me to start there again. I've been a reader my entire life, to start reading and reading, and because I always thought that religion was slavery unless it was liberating, and I still believe that to this very day. If religion doesn't liberate, it is slavery, and I believe that so many people of color around the world are not in a safe place. They're in slavery and they have no idea. So I started reading, and believe it or not, there was a guy on Albany Avenue. I love talking about Hartford because this is the city that I love and you know, believe can be a great city if we get right leadership in and wrong leadership out. And so there was a guy named Dr. Assagai. I believe he had a PhD in math and a PhD in engineering, and was a high school teacher over at Bloomfield High. And he had a bookstore in the Colin Bennett building. This is like in 1986, 85, 87, named Assagai Books. And it was there for years. It was about there for 10 years. And he was the only cat within a 100-mile radius that had black books. I'm talking about, that's where I learned the word Pan-Africanism. And so he had all these books in his bookstore, and I would go there, and I didn't have the money to buy the books. They were expensive. There were some books in there that was $50, because there were textbooks also about, you know, Pan-Africanism. And so he took a liking to me, which, you know, I would do the same with the young person, because I just was so wanting to read. And then he knew that my dad was a minister, and he was really trying to recruit me to African spirituality, and I was scared to do that then, because, you know, being Pentecostal, that's of the devil, because, you know, because the white man didn't endorse it. So anyway, he gave me a book by a gentleman by the name of James Cone. Why did he do that?
Wow.
It messed me up. It was called God
of the Disinherited.
Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely.
And so, of the Oppressed. Oh, of the Oppressed. Yeah. You remember that one? Yeah.
Jesus the Disinherited.
That's some Howard Thurman. Yeah. God of the Oppressed. God of the Oppressed. I was done. I read that book. It took me about 3 days to read it. I was messed up, because for the first time in my life, I got it. And it was weird, because the people in town, because I'm, you know, I'm a young preacher, so I knew every single pastor in town. You know, I knew, you know, every single one of them. I knew, you know, Bishop Bailey, and, you know, back then Dr. L. Van Johnson, and you know, all the greats. Dr. Thomas Hoyt, you know, was over at the UME Church at the time, and it was just a great pastors from that era. All of them, when they saw my enthusiasm, they all went to seminary for the most part. So they weren't standoffish to what I was saying. Nobody really jumped on the bandwagon except one man, Elvin Johnson. And he was the dude that wasn't afraid. You know, he's an AME cat. He was the cat that won the free. When I
the Reverend Doctor.
The Reverend Dr. Elvin Johnson, yes. And when I would bring that stuff up to him about James Cone, he was the only dude that wanted to talk. It was like, sit down and have something to eat. Let's go get a soda. Like, he wanted to talk about it. He wasn't afraid to deal with Black theology, which was very weird, because while no one wanted to publicly denounce it or denounce Cone, nobody really embraced it in the Harvard community. They were scared of Cone because Cone was saying stuff that nobody was saying on the planet. He was, you know, Cone was the reason why people in the hood in Harlem started putting up paintings of Black Jesus. You know, that was radical. You know, he got people in the Latin community in Harlem started putting up Puerto Rican Jesuses. Mm. He even had Asian folks putting up Asian Jesuses. And so people was freaking out because he had so messed up the status quo of what we think about the living Christ, and he became a threat to organized religion. I mean, he's since passed away, but the work that he has done was monumentous, because for the first time in our lives, we actually got to see ourselves as truly, authentically included. We would never talk about you. The word inclusion means a lot of things today, but back then we were not included. Even today, with, you know, a lot of things within the mega church movements around the country, we're really not included. We're a part of a system that helps to keep their coffers filled. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly European led mega ministries. We're there because we still want to feel included, but theoretically, we're not included. And that was a major, major problem for me, because I didn't want to just be the token sitting in the pews. If I was going to be there, I wanted to be there because I had an active role. I didn't just want to be the parking lot attendant at the mega church. I wanted to be able to be an elder. And you hear from me, you know, just like I hear from you. And he's the one that made that possible for us to believe that what we had to say was just as important, if not more important, than what they had to say. And that was big for me.
We're talking with Reverend Aaron Lewis, and we'll be back after the break.
You have been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches.
Killed.
Yeah, well, Kyle's not here.
How come?
Kicked off the team. Didn't Tim tell you? Kyle and some other kids got caught drinking beer in the park a couple of nights ago.
Really?
Yeah. Zero tolerance. He's out for the season.
Come on, it's a first offense, right?
That we know of. But why should that matter? He knew not to drink. I've made it clear to Matt, that's what we expect from him. What have you said to Tim?
Nothing really. You know, a lot of kids try it at this age, so.
Yeah, well, a lot of kids don't try it too. I'm not saying that Matt's gonna be this perfect kid, but if I don't tell him what we expect and why he shouldn't drink, how's he gonna know?
You think kids that age really listen?
They never admit it, Bill, but they hear more than you think.
Talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with kids about underage drinking, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Reckless love of God, always. falling for me. You've been so good.
You've been so, so good.
So, so good.
When I felt no
we like to call you Jesus, Jesus. That's what we call you, yeah.
Square feet. What would you do with that kind of possibility? Would you strategize your future? Or get lost in the past? Will you fill it with stories? Or use it to empty your mind? Would you explore your spirituality? Or focus on improving your community? Will you use it to work late? Or just work it? Could you create lasting impressions? Or a brief, delicious one? Our vision for the 224? 30,000 square feet of endless possibilities.
Welcome back. We're talking with Reverend Aaron Lewis. So talk to us about your ministry today.
Yes, I'm Family Church in Glastonbury, Connecticut, where we have services over at 65 Glastonbury Boulevard and the Homewood Suites Hotel right there in their ballroom. And so we've been there for a few years, and we're sort of in a relaunch stage, relaunching with a millennial mindset, and really just trying to get a fresh, new group of people to be relevant to 2019.
And so as you talk about your leadership at Family Church, mm-hmm. that's one aspect of your ministry, but you do a lot of work that's humanitarian in nature and global. So your ministry transcends the walls of the church. Talk about that.
Well, the transcendence has been really the the part of the ministry that I'm probably most proud of, the global mission. So I personally traveled both for publishing business as well as ministry to more than 61 countries in the world. And many of those countries in sub-Saharan Africa, in South America, Central America, even Europe. And we brought mission funding and medical supplies, doctors, dentists, teams of people to various countries around the world. We have a tremendous mission in Dominican Republic. We'll actually be going on next week to bring supplies and clothes to the children over there. And so that's really the heartbeat of what we do. We see our ministry as existing to have very long tentacles that reach into countries where people who are disenfranchised need our help in a very, very significant way. So we love staying on the move. We love, you know, I'm always telling people, don't throw your clothes away. We'll take them. You know, so you going through that spring cleaning, we'll take your clothes, because we bring them over to Dominican, you know, several times a year. We ship over there several times a year. And, you know, the things that you all throw away that, you know, ain't in style no more, well, is in real high fashion over there. And so we love to connect to that purpose, because it keeps us focused. It does. I mean, if you ever dedicated your life to missions, you stay in an eternal state of gratefulness, because you, no matter how bad things are here, you go a few places, you find out it really is not all that bad.
So when you do your work internationally, how does that impact your point of view in your ministry here?
Well, one of the things that I do that's sometimes not as traditional or as conventional is just going to bring supplies to people in Dominican or in South Africa or in Tanzania, is that I often, because of my training, will consult governments as well. So I've had the opportunity to consult several governments on two basic themes. One is healthcare, and as well as, and when I speak to healthcare, a lot of the work has been around AIDS and people being educated with regards to the disease and to protect themselves and that type of thing. And also, we're still looking for a cure for AIDS, and so we're in that process. But also education and education reform in these countries. I did work in Panama with regards to education and the just the working with the infrastructure. So interesting, because when you talk about how it impacts the work that we do here, I don't believe that a ministry should exist without a social justice arm. I'm just a diehard believer. When you say that you're a pastor and you don't have any ounce of social justice in you, then I just feel like you need to just pack up, you know, put stuff in a suitcase and leave. And so far too many ministries today have completely neglected the Jesus who was the Christ of social justice. They don't understand the Christ of the people, the justice Christ. They don't have any clue about it. And I don't think that a person who is truly Christian can separate themselves from that. If you are a true Christian, you have to care about the poor. You have to care about those who are hungry and feed them. You have to clothe the naked. You have to shelter those that are homeless. And to completely divorce yourself from that idea is dangerous. And so I work with governments to come up with ideas and plans of action so that the children can be educated, which of course brings about a stronger community, and then also to educate them with regards to how they can properly take care of themselves. And it's funny, because the work that I do overseas, much of the work that I do there is probably needed even more right in America. I mean, the education system in Harvard right now is deplorable. It's absolutely deplorable. And when I use words like that, I get pushback, which I you know, if anyone knows me.
It's deplorable, but not for a lack of money.
Not for lack of money. It's not for lack of money. It's the money has nothing to do with it, because you got to understand that the work that I do around the world, these people don't have $450 million budgets like one city. The countries don't have a $450 million budget. I need to say that one more time. The entire nation don't have a $450 million education budget. Right? The city of Hartford has a $450 million education budget. And so their entire country does not. But yet we see scholarship emerging out of these poor countries at a greater level. They don't have access to an Apple, you know, computer suite or a Dell computer suite. They may have one or two or three 10-year-old computers, you know, somewhere in the back that, you know, 200, 300 kids have to use these three, four computers. And so, but yet these kids end up going to tremendous colleges. You know, first line are HBCs all over America. And then the second line, you know, the Yales and the Harvards and the Princetons, you know, and I love our HBCs and all of the wonderful schools in the U.S. And we see children from foreign countries going to these schools, and our kids are not. And the reason why is because the problem exists here, probably even worse, but we have the illusion that things are all right here. We're so arrogant, it's scary, because until you're honest about the problems that exist, those problems are going to persist forever.
And so when you think about your ministry, what's your vision for the future? Where is God sending you? Where's your passion?
I mean, I definitely want to impact more nations and make some real genuine relationships with spiritual leaders in other parts of the world and those type of connections. But I think that my vision at this point, particularly as I'm, you know, looking at the next half of, you know, of my life, is to really find better ways to tap into millennials and even Gen Zs, Generation Zs, the young people. That's something that I think about every day. When I was growing up, the adherence to spiritual teachings was, you know, a bit easier to convey to my generation, only because we were a bit more docile. Even, you know, with my rebellious self, I still had some, you know, passivity on the inside of me somewhere, if you, you know, look hard enough. But anyway, we went to church. We, you know, tried to do what we were told. We tried to understand morality within the context that it was given. Millennials today need more proof. They need more basis for why they're told to do this, that, or the other. And we can't shy away from educating them and telling them. In other words, they deserve to know why. You know, you don't just tell them, don't do this or don't do that or don't go here or don't go there. You have to educate them. And I think that we've failed miserably with giving them valid reasons. I think we gave them the oppressor's reasons. And we have to stop doing that, because they're smart as can be. They have access to knowledge that we didn't, and they get it at warp speed. You know, if I wanted to listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, I'd have to go over to Roz Records on Barber Street and buy the LP when it came out. Well, today, guess what? They drop a single and boom, in seconds, you got it. And it's a different way of getting knowledge. And I think that the next phase is really being on the cusp of what God is doing now, and not so much lean on the history in a negative sense to hinder us from being able to reach people with a relevant message. They want to know what works. Now, we no longer drive in the horse and buggies, maybe Amish country. That's why everybody knows, you know, Amish country, you know, in Pennsylvania. We no longer do that. We drive cars now. And I think that we need to, you know, catch up with the times and become relevant, because it's nothing more disappointing than preaching a gospel that we preached 40 years ago that nobody ain't listening to no more, but we don't know it.
Mm. So someone wants to know more about your ministry. How do they find out more?
They can go to familychurch.faith, familychurch.faith. That's familychurch.faith. They can come check us out at 65 Glastonbury Boulevard, 10 o'clock Sunday mornings. And we'll be over there, you know,
having more of an extension of what we're doing right now.
Powerful. Thank you so much for being with us, Reverend Aaron Lewis.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace. Reach out to us and tell us what you think. Look for Rich Answers, the Conference of Churches, and me, Reverend Dr. Shelley Bess, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Like us, follow us, share us.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.